Today, we're reviewing the final piece of the Twin Peaks puzzle, Mark Frost's The Final Dossier. We're going to review all the information given to us that helps us piece together this entire mystery. We'll talk 119-911, artwork of Sirius, Donna's modeling with the elites, Audrey Horne theories, Annie Blackburn theories about 838 Antichrist Balerian symbolism. She's fine. Blavatsky's root races, Log Lady philosophies, Freemasonic darkness and light. Briggs comes with the heat. Tulpas, dwellers, and we reveal the secret word. Judy, today here on the Grey Lodge, I'm your host, Isaac Weishaupt. Now this book, The Final Dossier, a beautiful hardback book, which I ruined during my research, by the way. I had it open and I was taking notes from it, typing them up, and I bent the pages. Oh my gosh. Anyway. That's all right, though, you know? Even the Mona Lisa's falling apart. So, yeah, beautiful book. If you have the chance, a hardback is the preferred way. You can also do the audiobook, which I also have. And the book was published on October 31st, 2017, on the night of Samhain, right? Now, to put it into context, the other book, one of the other books we discussed, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, was released October 18th, 2016, so about a year prior. So the sequence was The Secret History of Twin Peaks in October of 16. Then Twin Peaks The Return started airing May 21st of 2017 and wrapped up September 3rd, 2017. And then about 2 months of digesting that finale from Twin Peaks The Return, you get The Final Dossier, which puts a nice bow on as much as they're going to give you. All right. Now, I believe, a lot of people say, well, you know, Twin Peaks, no one knows what's going on. I believe it's very clear what's going on, all right? Now, I can't explain that quite yet. I think the next episode, I'm going to do my best to explain it. When I say it's very clear, maybe that's a bit bold. I think it's fairly clear. I think, and that was the goal of this whole project, this whole Grey Lodge series was to... You know, in engineering, they say, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? It's kind of like that. We had to go through every single episode. I had to take notes on every single episode. I've got, how many pages? I'm at 353 pages of notes that I've typed up. That's almost 2 years of work. And this is the final piece. This is the final clue that we get. And in the next episode, I'm going to try to make it all make sense. I think I will. I don't know that, though. Don't hold it against me. And trust me, I'll leave... There's plenty of mysteries remaining that I definitely won't solve. But I think I got the main idea. And this book is the final piece of information that I need to use to support this theory. So, the book... So, it's again, just like Secret History, Tamara Preston, Agent Tammy Preston, wrote this book... As she wrote it to FBI Director Gordon Cole as a follow-up to the Secret History book, all right? Because Briggs wrote all that stuff in 1989 and disappeared, and she retrieved it, and that's what the Secret History was all of Briggs' findings and Tammy making notes about it, right? Well, this was written supposedly September 6th, 2017, so... Just a few days after the finale events of Twin Peaks The Return. All right? You feel me? So, let's see here. She said, she's like, I am now the archivist. So, she takes the baton from Briggs. And the whole idea of the book, Cole said, look, I need you to wrap up Twin Peaks. I need you to tell me what happened in Twin Peaks since 1989. Since... The disappearance of Major Briggs. So that's what this book is. It's got several chapters based upon different people and stuff. And the case numbers for each chapter, They start out with 008-072-0119. And I mean, I can't help but notice right off the bat, right? In Twin Peaks The Return, remember the junkie lady kept saying 119. And in part one, the police cruiser had the number on there. We talked about all this, right? And in part five, the clock, it said it was 8:55, but for 8:55, the clock hands are on 9 and 11, right? There's the 911. And I talked about how this is the magical formula. So 119 is the reversal, the inversion of the magical formula. And I guess maybe you could argue that it is the creation of the inversion is a creation of the Black Lodge characters. Maybe. I don't know. Just an idea. Kind of like how they invert a cross. Could be the same thing. So in part three, we talked about Kenneth Grant and his book Outside the Circles of Time. And I told you that the numbers 9 and 11 represent the lion serpent invoked by the hand. The 9th and 11th degrees of the OTO thus contain the mystery of the secret path. And then throughout all of Twin Peaks The Return, shows up multiple times. So 119 might be the reversal of coming back through the mystery of the secret path. And since we're talking gematria, if you add up the numbers on the case file, the beginning of it, the 08-072-0119, gematria-ically, it adds up to 10, right? I mean, technically it's 1 because you would finally say 1 plus 0, but let's just, for fun, adds up to 10. Which, as you know, is the number of completion, which took us into all the 253 numerology of this last season. Also, the artwork of the book. You're going to notice, and I'll put the images on the Instagram, at Isaac Weissop, like and subscribe. You're going to notice the artwork. There's triangles all over the covers, the front cover, the back cover, the inner covers. The triangle, of course, a magical symbol that represents manifestation, the creation, the final deed of the magician is the manifestation. Furthermore, when a triangle is upright, it represents the masculine. When it's inverted, it represents the feminine. So you could argue very easily that all of this symbolism that you find, if you're watching the video, I'm trying to find some examples here. All of the triangular symbolism you find shows uprights and inverted triangles together, all right? So you could argue it's showing us the locked unionizing of male and female, of the masculine and the feminine, locked in polarity. Like a key in the lock. And this will make more sense later, particularly next episode, my final episode. Also, if you notice in the rear inner cover, and I'll put the images on the Instagram again, the second page in on the rear cover, there's this black page, and if you don't look at it in the right lighting, good Lord. I don't know if you can see it on the video or not, but in the lighting, you can see the woodsman, you can see Bob, and you can see what I believe to be Sarah Palmer. Now recall that Sarah Palmer doesn't seem like a good person in Twin Peaks The Return. She's pulling off people's faces. She pulled off people's throats. She pulled off her face and showed us the Black Death. She was stabbing at Laura's homecoming photo. And arguably, depending on how you view part 18, she might have ended the whole world. So now we formally see her rightful place in the Legion of Black Lodge entities. There is a website, 25 years later site, that I want to attribute a finding to. You know, if I don't find stuff, I like to shout out the people who I seen it from. There was a write-up about this book from John Bernardi. And he says that these front cover triangles, if you look at them, they actually center in on the Great Northern Boiler Room, which, as you know from the end of part 18, or no, part 17? I think it's 17. Either way, you know what I'm talking about. After they take down Mr. C, and Cole, Cooper, and Diane, and One Arm Mike go in the boiler room, and he dimension jumps one final time. That's where it happens. John also revealed that inside of the dust jacket, which I didn't even realize, you can find, and I'll put the images up. I don't want to tear my book apart on the camera. You'll find a nebulous cloud and star, and he suggests that it's probably Sirius. And I like that, right? Because you can see there's two primary stars on that image. Sirius is a binary star, Sirius A, Sirius B. And, you know, if I pull it up on a Google image search, is it identical? I don't know. I don't think so, but I do think that, you know, John believes it could be Sirius based on the secret history of Twin Peaks' Sirius references, which it does reference Sirius, okay? And, you know, Sirius is the most important aspect when it comes to the occult. Crowley's Thelemic current supposedly comes, the magical current comes from Sirius. The Freemasons call it the Blazing Star. It's in every temple, every lodge. And we've talked about it a few times on this Grey Lodge journey. We talked about King Arthur towards the end of season two. We delved deep into King Arthur because King Arthur's story is the Dale Cooper story. It's about death and resurrection, King Arthur finding the divine feminine. And I referred you to a book by Mark Booth called The Secret History of the World. And he said, this is procession of the equinoxes with one constellation taking over after another. It's a seasonal showing of the resurrection of fertility with the annual cycle of seasons. Sirius on the horizon, after the time spent hidden, is the sign that Osiris is resurrecting and the Nile will be fertile. Tammuz, Marduk, Fisher King, and King Arthur all follow the same pattern. The king is fatally wounded. The land stays barren, and in the spring, magic resurrects him and fertilizes the land. And then in The Secret History of Twin Peaks, the book, we talked about that as well. It was 1949 when Doug Milford writes up an interview he did with Jack Parsons. That's right, the Jack Parsons. And Parsons revealed how he and L. Ron Hubbard were out in the desert doing these rituals and saw things that men should never see, aliens, basically. And he details his sightings of greys from Zeta Reticuli, Nordics from the Dog Star. That's Sirius. The Dog Star is Sirius. And Twin Peaks mentions it in the margins for the reader who wasn't aware. Now, John postulates that the giant, a.k.a. the fireman, could be one of the tall aliens. And a Nordic from Sirius. I like it. And then finally, we talked about Sirius with the discussion about Kenneth Grant, where Kenneth Grant claimed he discovered an extraterrestrial current called the Sirius Set Current. And he suggested it was an energy emanating from the goddess Nuit. Nuit is important in the Egyptian cosmology as well as Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law. Now, a little sneak preview. We're going to talk about Nuit in the final wrap-up. I've got some bangers of ideas that I'm going to float by you. We'll see which ones you like. Hint, you're going to love all of them. And you know why I can't wait to do this? I can't wait because I'm dying to watch this dude that has a 4-hour video on YouTube explaining Twin Peaks. I want to know what this guy found. Everyone talks about it. They say, like, this is the one. Like, he's got it figured out. And I didn't watch it on purpose because I don't want to affect how I view this. But I can't wait to watch it because I'm wondering if he came to the same conclusions, right? How could he? There's no way, right? There's no way other people are digging into all this occult literature, but maybe. I mean, it points clearly to it. So we'll see. We'll see. Leo Johnson is the first chapter. And yeah, most of these we're going to gloss through, okay? I'm going to read you in case you're like, man, I don't want to read this book. I want you to tell me what it says. I'll catch you up on the main characters, but I'm going to go deeper into some of the more esoteric stuff. So Leo Johnson, Albert, did it. And this is all going back to like 1989, all right? Albert did an autopsy on Leo. He was shot in the chest, presumably Wyndham Earl. Albert comments about how the world's a better place without him. But remember what I said at the end of season two? Leo kind of had a redemption story, I thought. Leo was worried about Shelley, in a way, you know. When he was like, trapped in Wyndham Earl's cabin, he was worried about trying to get to Shelley because he saw that Wyndham was going to go get Shelley. But whatever. Everyone deserves a path to redemption. Even Leo Johnson. Then we got a chapter on Shelley Johnson. We find out that she had met Leo at the Roadhouse, and it happened the night of the junior prom. She got into a fight with Bobby Briggs because he had an affair with Laura, and she stormed out, went to the Roadhouse to get some drinks. And there's Leo ready to scoop up, and he did. Now, after Leo Johnson died, Shelley, who was already seeing Bobby Briggs, you know, started going public with him. She gets pregnant. That's Becky, who we see in season three, or The Return, I should say. And then she got pregnant, and then they got married. Then we find out that Norma Jennings, her husband Hank, got shanked in the prison. He's dead. But Norma Jennings and Betty Briggs helped Bobby and Shelley get their stuff together, get a house, whatever. Strangely enough, we don't get much on Bobby Briggs. Somehow Bobby became a police officer, but I don't think he's even mentioned in this book, besides there. Then we move on to the Horns and the Haywards. They talk about the night of the bank explosion that we saw at the end of season two. And Tammy talks about how Ben was treated with a head injury that night at Calhoun Memorial. If you recall, Dr. Haywood and him got into it. Well, Dr. Haywood hit him because Ben Horn was actually Donna's real father, and Dr. Haywood never wanted Donna to find out. But Ben came around trying to be a good dude. But anyway, Dr. Haywood whooped that ass, and his head hit the fire mantle. And so Dr. Haywood takes Ben to the hospital and says that they both agree that with the story that Ben slipped at the fireplace. Then we find out in this chapter also that Cooper, after he returned from the Grove, so we're talking about Mr. C, we find out that Mr. C was also taken to Calhoun Memorial after the end of season two, where he bashes his head against the mirror. And the Calhoun Memorial was interesting because we talked about this in the season two wrap up, how I referred to the Jack Parsons show Strange Angel in a section of the show where he talks about crossing the abyss using Aleister Crowley rituals and such. And Jack Parsons opens up a book, that an unidentified book, I don't know what it was. And Jack talks about how crossing the abyss, you become one with the divine. And the image presented is shows the 30 Aethers of John Dee, which is talk about talking to spirits and going from the lowest point, Malkuth, on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and moving towards the cosmos, toward becoming God, towards the divine. It's about going through the physical realm to the subconscious mind, to the conscious mind, to the abyss, and then to God. So it seems that Mr. C was coming back from that process, maybe, from God through the abyss of the Black Lodge, regaining consciousness, and finally being in the physical realm. Like, he wanted to do evil deeds, right? Mr. C slash Bob. So Mr. C, Cooper, checked himself out of the hospital the next morning. And within 2 days, he leaves Twin Peaks, disappears for 25 years. All right. Now, Doc Haywood saw Cooper that morning, Mr. C, and he saw him coming out of Audrey Horn's room. And then Audrey Horn, 9 months later, gives birth to Richard Horn. The book quite literally spells it out for us. And the birth certificate for the father says unknown. So now we know that Audrey was raped by Mr. C. And he had multiple victims of this, as per Twin Peaks The Return, which means Richard Horn is sort of part, like the Nephilim, right? Part demonic, part human. We also find out that Major Briggs was declared dead after the fire at the outpost. Now, the sort of subcontext is that he meets up with Cooper, who's Mr. C, Briggs realizes that, oh crap, Bob came through, and he starts the Mayday protocols, which involves destroying all the equipment and faking his own death or whatever that was. So he's declared dead because of the fire at the outpost, because they found a couple teeth in it that match his dental record. And within 3 months of all these events, Dr. Hayward moves to Vermont. Him and his wife get divorced. Donna leaves. She goes to New York City. So that leaves Eileen, Harriet, and Gersten to stay in Twin Peaks. And Ben was paying Eileen $7,500 a month. What do you call it? What's that called? Alimony, yeah. So, next chapter, Donna. Donna moves to New York City, and she becomes a model. She works with Ford Models. And we talked about this weird pipeline of models and modeling companies trying to get poor women from, generally, from Eastern Bloc countries and connecting them into the circle of elites, these old rich dudes. Sometimes it's for nefarious abuse. Sometimes it's for marriage and a green card. Sometimes it's true love. We talked about this in our Blink Twice episode, because Epstein and Jean-Luc Brunel had the MC2 modeling company. Diddy had Sean John. Trump had Trump Models, and that's where he scooped up his wife, Melania. They met when she was 28 and he was 52. So I don't want to hear no grief about my boy Leo, you know? You know what I'm saying? Okay, so, and just like all his modeling companies, we find out that Donna, after becoming a model through Ford Models, marries an old rich dude. Wow, would you look at that. So Donna, and again, no shade, I don't care. As long as they're consenting adults, by all means. Donna meets up with Laura Budding up in New York, and Donna's life starts to unravel. She goes to rehab a bunch of times, psychiatric hospitals, moves to Connecticut, divorces. She reconciles with her dad, moves in Vermont. Eileen's dead. She's working towards nurse practitioner stuff. But back in Twin Peaks, Gersten, she's still alive. She was a genius. She graduated at 16, goes to Stanford, one of the MK Ultra schools, by the way, had a nervous breakdown. And it's confirmed here that she was the one dating Steven. She was the one in the woods when he killed himself. She was the one with him at that tree, right? But she's gone now. She's disappeared. So who knows? Next chapter, Ben and Audrey Horn. Ben and Sylvia also divorced from the fallout of the fatherhood issue. Sylvia assumes sole custody of Johnny. So now we've confirmed that was Johnny in the, in the scenes in the house. How did Johnny get out? Hello, Johnny. How are you today? That whole thing. You know, the one Richard was going to cornhole. What? I mean, that guy was evil. I mean, anyway, so after the bank explosion, we find out that Audrey was in a coma for 3.5 weeks with no memory of the event. Which substantiates my point earlier that Mr. C/Bob did, in fact, rape Audrey. She was in a coma. Man, I mean, Twin Peaks goes hard in the paint. When it goes hard in the paint, it goes hard in the paint. It goes from dark to light like nothing. So Ben Horn proceeded to go and, in fact, sell that ghostwood thing that he was trying to sell that Audrey was protesting, and it turns into a privatized prison. Audrey moves out of her house after her coma of 3.5 weeks to raise her child at the age of 19. She opens a hair salon. She never speculates who the father was or took a paternity test. Hinting she already knew it was, she thought, Cooper, right? I guess. Like, I don't know how she would come to that conclusion, but whatever. She kept a framed photo of Cooper at the salon. Recall Richard, when he goes to confront Mr. C with his gun. Remember, because Richard saw Mr. C at the gang hideout, and he was like, oh, I recognize that dude. He was on my mom's hair salon wall. He's a Fed. He's an FBI agent. Remember? That was the whole thing there. Audrey ends up marrying her accountant, a marriage of financial convenience, people say. The marriage is rife with abuse, infidelity, and therapy, all on Audrey's part. She goes to mental health. Cases are sealed. Nobody really knows why. 4 years ago, she closes the salon and goes into seclusion. And one rumor is that she's in a private care facility. That's what the book says. And the Horn family has not commented. So, let's back up to the last time we saw her, which I believe was part 16. At the end of part 16, she does Audrey's dance, and then she sort of like snaps to attention, and she's in that white room with the mirror, and she's wearing a white shirt or whatever, and she's like panicking, right? My thought before reading this book would be, oh, she's still in the coma from the bank blast, but apparently that's not true. It could be that she's in a psychiatric facility for up to 4 years, though. That's what we can ascertain here. And I thought maybe she was in a coma, but that would require her to give birth in a coma, which is pretty rare from what I read. But then we also find out she was running a salon the whole time. She was only in the coma 3.5 weeks, you know, that kind of thing. And there's various theories you could run with on Audrey's current status. Some people talk about tulpas and, you know, not likely. Comas, not likely. Mental breakdown, likely, right? She had a lot of abuse, a lot of trauma. I mean, she got raped by a demon. She thought it was Dale Cooper, though. I don't know. You could go, and I wish they did an Audrey spinoff. I wish so hard. But, you know, you don't get what you want all the time. So Ben Horn's Ghostwood deal, they sold it to make a privatized prison. The book talks about them denying unionizing efforts and making the local area worse with drug addiction, alcoholism, depression. And we found out that the chief admin was Warden Murphy. That's the guy from Buckhorn that Mr. C has assassinated, remember? And look, I'm sure this links into the whole thing with Mr. Strawberry and all that. Again, I'm not answering every mystery of Twin Peaks. We'd be here forever. But I think that's the entryway into that whole subplot. They talk about the Ghostwood prison had some collusion issues with police to increase the arrest rates and increase the prison client population. This is the vacancy fill rates. We talked about this in my second book, Sacrifice Magic Behind the Mic. The privatized prison system, which isn't all prisons, but I think it's maybe like a third or up to a half, maybe. There's a profit motive, and the local police promise these companies will keep it full up, you know, X amount full for you, because you got to run it as a business. But I mean, just the ethics of that sounds crazy, right? Then we get Jerry Horn. Look, Jerry's just doing tons of drugs, all right? We already know what's going on with him. Double R. We got the story about how Annie Blackburn came about, if you're interested. Marty Lindstrom, who's Norma's father, faked his death in 1978 to start a family with Vivian Smith. After Marty died, Vivian married Ronald Blackburn. Annie is told by her mother that Marty was just her uncle, and it's when she learned about the truth that she went looking for her real father and she found Norma. And Tammy believes, based on some guesses, that Roland or Ronald would eventually attempt to sexually assault Annie, which led him to killing himself. Or there's allegations of someone cutting his brake lines too. And that's why Annie had all these traumas and went to a psychiatric facility and has all these mental health issues, right? So then we get a chapter about Annie Blackburn, a brief one. She talks about Dale Cooper having the white knight syndrome of wanting to protect and save women and roots it in his troubled relationship with his own mother and how he apparently had to take care of her or tend to her. And I believe I already talked about this a little bit, the idea that this is, again, part of the coffee test, the identification with the ego, and that's why he tries to save Laura in The Return, which, you know, Tammy suggests he did have an obsession with the Laura Palmer case, but he also got into trouble with Annie and Caroline Earle. They were also abused that he tried to sort of, I don't know, fell in love with them. Then we get Wyndham Earle. Hey, just like, I'm like Wyndham Earle, graduate degrees from Penn State. Isn't that beautiful? Project Blue Book was his connection to Blue Rose. Annie was, then they talk about Annie some more, right? Annie was after she came out of the Grove. So Wyndham just disappeared. They don't know what happened to him. So Annie, she came out of the Grove and she had good vitals, but no response whatsoever. And she needed assistance just to get up, to walk around, but she never spoke. She never acknowledged anyone's presence. Norma ends up taking her in and taking care of her. And 1 year to the day after she was found in the woods, Norma found her trying to kill herself again. And the next morning, she said one sentence. The first sentence she said in over a year, she said, "I'm fine." And she does this every year at 8:38 on the same day, on the one-year anniversary. And of course, this is a reference to the season two finale where Dale Cooper / Mr. C / Bob is ranting on and on, "How's Annie? How's Annie?" Like it's a response to that. Now, recall in the season two wrap-up, I talked to you about Jack Parsons' Book of the Antichrist. And we talked about how it's all about this incoming new age. And he signs it at the end, Belarion 8 equals 3. And when you sign it 8 equals 3, it's a degree, meaning you've annihilated the self and crossed the abyss. And 8 equals 3 means you identify with no thing. You cease to exist. All right. And I also talked about how it's interesting because season 3, episode 8 was kind of the one that exposed everything, the Trinity Blast episode. And it's very much Jack Parsons affiliated here. So my idea here is that 8:38 every year, Annie says, "I'm fine." It's symbolic in the sense of her being forced in a way by Wyndham to cross the abyss, or failing to cross it, obviously. And she identifies, but so maybe she did cross, and now she identifies with no thing and ceases to exist, because that's kind of her state that she's in right now. Now, then Miss Twin Peaks, we find out that the because Annie couldn't do her her duties as Miss Twin Peaks, they went to the second runner-up, which is Lana Budding, if you recall, who was married to Doug Milford. And she apparently got that jade ring, and she moves to New York, and she marries some New York real estate grifter. It's clearly a reference to Donald Trump. Look, Mark Frost is a very liberal dude, and he took a shot at, it's funny. Come on, we can laugh, right? We don't all have to agree. But the photo shows him wearing that jade ring, right? No comment, but how strange the events that have taken place since this book is all I'm going to say. So next chapter, Dr. Jacoby. This is one of the denser chapters I'm going to talk about. We find out his license got revoked, and he moved to Hawaii to search for a way to reinvent himself. And he works with a bunch of Hawaiian shamans and studies the mythologies of the Metahuni, which we hear is a root race. Now, this is a term that comes from Helena Blavatsky's Beliefs in Theosophy. It's about the evolution of man through lost civilizations like Atlantis or Lemuria. And she had thought we had four previous root races, and these are stages of human evolution, basically. And we're currently in the fifth one, which they call the Aryan, which apparently includes all skin colors, so don't go with the, that side of it. But we all evolved from one survivor of Atlantis from the fourth root race, I guess. And she also believed that the next race was coming in the 21st century in California, and this would be human beings with psychic potentials, which is very much like Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End. And after that, the seventh root race, which I think she said was like the 28th century, would be the collapse of mankind. We are now non-gender, non-material, and we are just spiritual beings, which is where the 2001 Space Odyssey series take. You know, Arthur C. Clarke was into this too. Anyway, Jacoby, you know, he was doing all of his hippie stuff. He was going on the road with the Grateful Dead. He was a spiritual advisor to Jerry Garcia, worked with some institute in Amsterdam to raise human consciousness, a bunch of political activism. I have notes here that I don't even understand what I'm saying. Views. Oh, boy. Goes to Florida, works political activism, views one as a karmic attack that would result in an overreaction. I don't know what I was trying to say there. Oh, he was saying there's going to be an event that was a karmic attack that would result in an overreaction, and it would be the first toll in striking midnight of the American experiment and kick off a more destructive karmic cycle, and the world would enter Kali Yuga, the Dark Age. And in 2003, oh, I think this is referring to 2001. 2003, he goes back to Twin Peaks for this to be there for the final cycle. Now, this is all very interesting. When you years ago, when I interviewed Professor Ben Teitelbaum, his book War for Eternity, which reveals how Steve Bannon is very much into Julius Evola, René Guénon, and their theories of traditionalism, which very much subscribes to this idea of ushering in this final age or completing out this final age so that they can be in power to instill the traditional movement that they want. Kind of interesting, don't you think? Dr. Amp, so he becomes this conspiracy theorist, Dr. Amp, very much into this idea of 60s radicalism, evils of what he calls cannibal capitalism and corporatism. He's selling the boner juice medicine to counter all that. He gains a national audience. I guess the mainstream media wanted to hire him and stuff, but he was like, no. And they were throwing cash at him. He's like, nope, I don't want it. So respect. His ideas of digging yourself out of the shit led to direct mail sale of gold shovels, and they were symbolism of alchemy. So there we go. There's the proof that the gold is, in fact, a reference to alchemy. The lead of dull consciousness into gold and the perfection of the soul is what the shovel stands for. They talk about James's case with the murder and Evelyn, and Tammy even says, I won't bore you with the details, because everyone hates that part of season two. I don't. I it's endearing to me. I love James. I love everything about him. Even the Evelyn storyline. I know it's a controversial take, but I love all Twin Peaks. Even when the Twin Peaks purists that are mad that Bob Iger made Lynch change the direction, it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't want to change anything. It's like, did we not learn the lesson from Dale Cooper trying to save Laura Palmer? You can't go back and change one thing. Now the whole thing's different. And whatever the formula is of Twin Peaks, it works. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Norman and Big Ed get married. Beautiful. Log Lady chapter. Good one. Short one. Beautiful little philosophy chapter of how to live in this world. She says, life is what it is, a gift that is given to us for a time, like a library book, that must eventually be returned. How should we treat this book? If we are able to remember that it is not ours to begin with, one that we're entrusted with, to care for, to study and learn from, perhaps it would change the way we treat it. Perhaps it would change the way we treat it while it's in our possession. Then she talks about simple truths about the world that can help us grow, but people are afraid. One truth is that there's no light without darkness. So to understand that, you have to look into the darkness. All right. And about how they move in cycles. And just like Twin Peaks The Return, we had some highs, we had some lows. It's very cyclical, right? The whole show is a lesson of accepting light and dark. And you don't get that with superhero movies, right? That's why, look, people that are into Twin Peaks, it's not a giant audience. It's not for everyone. You know what's for everyone? Superhero movies. The good guy wins. It's what you want to happen. That's what they give you. But it's not real. That's not real at all. It wouldn't be popular because there's this inherent need for the audience to want tidiness and completion and justice. And like, that's just not real life. And that's what Twin Peaks is. You get light, you get dark, and you get everything in between. So having Twin Peaks, The Return, end on a dark note is such to make the light very obvious. Because now when you go back to the season 1, season 2, where Cooper's eating donuts and he's pinching Truman's nose, like, that's cute. It makes you laugh a little bit. It's endearing. We find out from Log Lady that time is a cycle we move through. And when we're in a dark age, you have to hold the light inside. And there's dark demonic forces, but they're part of the dance too. They're just listening to different music. Pretty interesting. And you can eventually recognize the light in yourself and within others. And you can find each other and make the light stronger. And the darkness always yields to light when the light is strong. And all this talk about light and dark is a very Freemasonic idea. It's used in Freemasonic initiation. The floors are black and white checkers, just like the Red Room has the floors that are black and white zigzags. I know, dark brown and white zigzags, got it. But they use light as a reference for enlightenment and wisdom, and the dark is a reference to ignorance or the mundane or wearing the hoodwink. Then we get a chapter on Briggs. This is probably the one I've got the most notes about. Mr. C left the hospital, as we know, went to go meet with Briggs. Briggs didn't trust it. He's like, oh, snap. He initiates the Mayday Protocol, destroying all the data, disabling the technologies. And it's believed that he had been attacked based on the dentals found within a car of his that was on fire. And the only suspect in any of this could have been Mr. C. Tammy suggests that it also could have been staged by Briggs, who took the dossier with him, apparently. But anyways, they both disappear for 25 years. That's the last connection. So enter the search for the zone, the website of William Hastings and Ruth Davenport, where William Hastings meets the Major, entering this non-physical dimension at specific times and places in Buckhorn, which is where Cole saw that portal, remember? And from here, the Major sets them out to find coordinates from a military database. They get them. They return a second time to deliver these coordinates. And that's when Major Briggs floats up and his head disappears. And the woodsmen attack and they kill Ruth. William had lost memory of the event until he got arrested. The FBI discovered that Briggs had a secret dossier and Ruth hid it in her basement locker in her apartment. That's how we retrieve it. And the Major had taken this with him everywhere for 25 years. But lots of questions remain, like, were the coordinates the location where Briggs entered and planned his exit from this zone and time stood still for 25 years? Because remember, his body hadn't aged. And the hack of the federal database to get the coordinates implies that the knowledge of the zone and this portal talk was in the possession of the feds, possibly Doug Milford, who gave it to Major Briggs. So is it possible that Briggs hid the coordinates on the note in the chair for Bobby to find later? You know, that Alcave map and so on. Mr. C ran an international syndicate for those 25 years, got tons of money, but he was actually more into research than anything. He wanted those coordinates as part of his research. And this is where we find out that Ray was an informant for Blue Rose. The glass box operation was a trap to catch a demonic entity. She uses that term, demonic. So what if Mr. C was looking for the Grand Central Station of Portals? And why? And she suggests maybe immortality. We find out that the Black Lodge is a place for people walking the dark path. I said, wait a minute. That's the name of my book. The Dark Path, which I find curious because I hadn't watched Twin Peaks at this point. I had no idea what a Black Lodge was at this point. Hawk, Deputy Hawk Tua, talked about the Dweller on the Threshold and in the towards the end of season two, and in the book it gets referenced again, and references the Dweller as the sum total of all dark negative qualities unresolved to human beings. And when a person is on a spiritual path and is ready to reach enlightenment, they have to get past this last obstacle that's at the threshold, the Dweller. And if you recall, Cooper had that little speech when he was about to get arrested. I'm going to cover that later. And she asked, was Mr. C the Dweller? And she talks about a concept in Tibet of a tulpa and says that it does not mean doppelganger, but rather an entity created or summoned by a dark magician or sorcerer through the practice of ancient and corrupt forms of esoteric magic, necromancy, demons, devil worship. Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who wrote extensively about these matters in the 19th century, setting aside for a moment the many arguments about whether or not she was an outright charlatan, referred to this sect as the Brothers of the Shadow. I bring this up to make the point that the Dweller scenario, in the Doubles case at least, seems more likely to me than the Tulpa. So she's suggesting that Mr. C was a Dweller on the Threshold, not a Tulpa. Or Briggs is, excuse me. Briggs is saying that Mr. C, Bob, fits the concept of a Dweller more than a Tulpa. Excuse me. And we saw what happened at the sheriff station at the end of the return. The moment of death, something came out of Mr. C's body, right? And Cooper and Cole went on to the location of what I think is the coordinates, which is the boiler room in the Great Northern. Diane disappeared. So did Cooper. Cole said he was in the boiler room of the Great Northern at this endless corridor, which closed. Cooper and Diane were gone. And then all of a sudden, Cole was back in an ordinary boiler room. All right, next chapter. Philip Jeffries. He was at a Buenos Aires outpost when he disappeared on February 16th, 1989, I think. And then after 6 months is when he shows up at Philly, which is the scene in Fire Walk With Me. He then disappears again and also shows up in Buenos Aires at the exact same time. And Tammy is like curious as to why he was so distraught about what year it is when he goes to the Philly offices. And she says that Jeffries was into the occult and he had stopped researching it. And Tammy suggests he stopped researching it and started living in Buenos Aires in 1986. Now, I think my notes are wrong. I think Tammy's saying that he really got into the occult in 1986 when he went to Buenos Aires. And he found a figure running an organization, and it was the name he said in Gordon Cole's office. The name was Judy. Judy was running an occult organization. He said, we're not going to talk about Judy. Well, guess what the next chapter is? Judy, we're going to talk about her. Tammy had found that Philip Jeffries carved a name in the wall by his phone in Buenos Aires. J-O-U-D-Y. Jowdy. Or Zudy, as they say on the audiobook. He wrote it in a pocket knife, scratched it in a hurry. Now, Judy is a Sumerian demon, she says, from 3000 BC. Well, would you look at that? She said it's a wandering demon called Utuku, that escaped from the underworld and rips souls from victims as nourishment and feeds off human suffering. And she tells us these demons exist in both male and female. So all these years, Philip Jeffries says we're not going to talk about Judy, and now we get this major reveal. And when we talk about this time period, we're talking about the Mesopotamians and the Akkadian Empire and their demonology, which takes us into ancient alien territory, Anunnaki, and so on. So this is huge. It's funny because this is the final piece of the puzzle. You need to put it all together. And I couldn't talk about it yet because we weren't going to talk about Judy until this book. Now, we also hear that Baal, B-A-A-L, a.k.a. Moloch, Baal is the male version of a Sumerian demon, And Judy is the female version of the Sumerian demon. And these are very much a reference to Bob, right? Because Bob literally rips souls from victims and feeds off human suffering. We can ascertain that. So Bob has got to be, I guess, Ball? The male version? She says they're dangerous individually, but if they merge together in marriage, that's it. It's a wrap. It's the end of the world. The end of the world. That's why the FBI and the Blue Rose case are very, take this very seriously. She then says Baal would later be identified as a false god Beelzebub or the devil. And recall the cover of the book has upright and inverted triangles meshed together. And I think this is a depiction, symbolically, of the messaging of Judy and Baal locked in sexual union. The marriage, the apocalyptic marriage, the end of the world. That's what I think this is. And this is such a massive, complex topic. And we're going to address it in the final wrap-up show next episode. As promised, we'll be looking at Kenneth Grant's Outside the Circles of Time again, because you won't believe what I found. Here's a hint. The Initiation of Aosic. That's the name of the chapter that I find. This information. We're going to look at themes of sex magic. We're going to look at Tracy Twyman's research, the apocalypse, the magnetism of polarities finding each other, King Arthur finding the divine feminine, Baal and Judy in their apocalyptic marriage. It's all here. And I know that's a big tease. I know if people that know Twin Peaks already and were following this whole time are like, my God, you finally get a chance to talk about Judy. Let's talk about it. I know, but it's a massive topic. It's really the crux of the whole show. And, you know, I don't understand every aspect of Twin Peaks, but this is the one aspect that I hear loud and clear. And I would argue most people have no idea. As much as I want to deep dive into it right now, we have to wait because I gotta finish up some stuff, cross some T's, dot some I's. I got a lot of research to do before I can complete this analysis. Next chapter is on Ray Monroe. We find out he was an informant. He was reporting directly to Philip Jeffries. Mr. C wanted Ray to tell him where to find Philip. They don't know why. Tammy theorizes that Philip and Briggs had been in touch with portals that unhook from time, which is why Philip was so upset to learn what year it was. Okay. Monroe had a matchbook for the Dutchman's Lodge. We find out that was in rural Montana. This is the convenience store. And the records show it was a 1930s motel opened by a mob-friendly establishment by a guy named the Dutchman. And it was demolished in 1967 after his death. And it's between Missoula and Twin Peaks. Missoula, of course, is where Laura's cousin, Maddie, is from. You're going back to Missoula, Montana, which I think is also where David Lynch is from. Tammy thinks maybe these portals and hooking and unhooking into these portals that where time is suspended disassociates you from time and space, and it really messes you up because you never quite know where you are or what year it is. So when Philip says, "Who do you think that is there?" and points to Cooper, that was Philip Jeffries from the future, knowing that Cooper goes into the Black Lodge and Bob comes out. So he thought that was Mr. C because he didn't know what year it was yet. So that puts a nice bow on that. Then the last chapter today, we find out that this is, in fact, a new timeline. We find out that the events from Part 18 created a new reality, a new timeline. Tammy looked up the disappearance of Cooper in the Twin Peaks Gazette and saw an article talking about Laura Palmer's disappearance, not her murder, her disappearance, right? Because you remember in part 18 or part 17, Cooper adjusts the timeline by saving Laura from getting murdered and, you know, and then Pete Martell gets to go fishing. So that apparently happens. But Laura Palmer disappears and they never find her. And Tammy called the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Office and says, Laura Palmer disappeared? She was murdered, right? And they all are they have amnesia, memory loss. They're like, I don't know. I don't remember. And Ronette, I guess she was still found, but she says Laura was never there now. And so that means now in this new timeline, Leland isn't dead. So a year after Laura's disappearance, Leland kills himself. And then Tammy says she looks up this new timeline for Sarah Judith Novak Palmer. Sarah Palmer, Laura's mother. So here we get the biggest clue. Sarah's middle name is Judy. Judith. And we find out that Sarah grew up in New Mexico at Los Alamos Housing because her dad worked for the Trinity, the Manhattan Project at the Trinity site there. And through, and look, I could have got this, I've heard this information on many locations in the Twin Peaks world, that it's heavily believed that Sarah Palmer is the girl in the episode of the Trinity, you know, part 8, that frog moth bug crawls into her mouth. She is Judy, because that demonic frog moth possesses her body with Judy in the same way that Bob possesses Leland. It's not spelled out entirely, but it seems to be what's going on. Given all the details of Sarah Palmer ripping out dudes' throats and taking her face off, and at the end of season 2 telling Cooper, "I'm in the Black Lodge." Or, no, who'd she tell that to? Truman or something. Anyway, the August 6th, 1956 newspaper shows that 15 miles away from Sarah Palmer's, Novak household, there was this murder spree, multiple weird sightings of hobos and electrical interferences, and Sarah was found unresponsive in her bedroom and taken to the ER. They were only a few hours from Roswell. And Sarah would eventually grow up, move to Washington, give birth to Laura. And after Laura's disappearance, she also got depressed, alcoholism, and all that. So now we know Sarah Palmer is Judy. Judy. Possessed with Judy. The female apocalyptic celestial marriage with Bob is what we're worried about now, maybe. Okay, then we get final thoughts. Good God, we're almost done. Tammy gets bugged out by all of this Twin Peaks stuff. She's like, I'm out of here. She heads back to Philly. And she talks about how the people of Twin Peaks must have been important for Gordon Cole. She talks about how everything's there in Twin Peaks, life from the cradle to the grave. She describes Twin Peaks as a fractal or an ocean and a drop of water. And she talks about how we can view the world in wonder or we can view it in fear. And if we are consumed with fear, then time becomes our executioner. This is a Saturnian idea, right? Saturn is the idea of time, measurements, death. In the perspective of the occult, you need death for there to be life. The skull is the dead matter that allowed mankind to evolve to have conscious thought. So they look at it as you kind of need both. You need the darkness and you need the light, which is what they talk about in this chapter. We have to face the fears in wonder. And if you recall season 2, episode 11, Cooper gets interrogated by the FBI. Remember this? When Roger Hardy tries to arrest him, Cooper says, I'll own up to where I broke the FBI code. Agent Rogers implies that he's spineless. But then Cooper has this interesting talk about how he's had this awakening and now he's looking to bigger issues. He says he's focusing beyond the edge of the board to a bigger game. Chessboard, black and white checkers. He said he's looking at what lies beyond the darkness, and he's talking about seeing beyond fear and looking at the world with love. So he was attempting to fully embody this philosophy, possibly confronting the shadow, continuing on his path of the one, just like Briggs indicated was his fate. He was like, I compared him to Neo in the Matrix, right? He sees through the illusory nature of reality, and he sees past the fear. And he's like the Buddha opening his mind up to break from the samsara reality, the repeating loop of karma symbolized by the donuts and the fans and the circles. And he can break free from this repeating cycle of samsara once he's enlightened, arguably cross the abyss, and become an ascended master who can help others become enlightened and break free from the cycle. Is that the happy ending we got in part 18? Doesn't seem like it. So that's it for the final dossier. Great book. Highly recommend. Especially if you're into Twin Peaks. You got to have it. Required reading. And we're almost done. The next and final installment of the Grey Lodge, we're going to do a wrap up of season 3. I'm going to wrap up season 3. What we need to pull out of all this, out of, you know, 18 hours of show, how it fits into the world of the esoteric and the occult and the philosophy. I'm going to pull out what I think the hidden messages are, or not so hidden, I guess. And then we're going to bump it up a little bit against the season 2 wrap up and try to come up with a conducive idea, a theory, an elevator speech for why Twin Peaks is great. Can we do it? Isn't it even possible? You know, because everyone asks you, why do you love this Twin Peaks so much? And you can't, you're like, it's hard to say it. It's hard to spit it out. We're going to try to. We're going to try to solve a lot of mysteries, and we're going to reveal the genius of David Lynch and Mark Frost. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for supporting the show, and thank you for joining me again in the Grey Lodge, and join me in the final wrap-up party as we reveal the hidden truth of the occult symbolism of Twin Peaks. Stay positive.